On tonight's LNL, a chat I had with Christopher Hitchens when he was in Sydney for the Writers Festival. Elena, take it away.
Late Night Live, ideas and opinions from around the world.
G'day, beloved listeners. Welcome to another LNL. For 25 years, I've sat here saying, you never hear it, but I have to say it, Peter Piper picked a pickled pepper. Today's guest, tonight's guest, says I've been getting it wrong. Or what should I have been saying, please?
Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled pepper, because the peck is the unit of measurement. That's what tests the whole hypothesis.
I feel sort of absolutely destroyed by this.
And bear is the thing. It's like round the rugged rocks, the ragged rascal ran, which people in England used to say would be the perfect thing for Roy Jenkins to say, if you remember who he was.
Vividly. I'm not going to introduce you yet. Many of the books I deal with here, dear listener, have this, the weight and substance of a packet of Kleenex tissues. You know, you pull them out and they're light and airy. This, the book I hold in my hand, which is called Hitch 22, a memoir, it's not really a memoir, it's much too substantial to be called a memoir, is intense and extraordinary. And really the only way to deal with it, I would think, is to have the author read it a page at a time, from page 1 to page 423, and for me to put my hand up from time to time and raise an objection or ask a question. But Christopher Hitchens says he hasn't got all that time to spend. It is indeed he, of whom his friend Ian McEwan says on the front cover, if Hitchens didn't exist, we wouldn't be able to invent him. An interesting comment, isn't it, Christopher?
It's a nice variant on an old saw, supposedly by Voltaire, which I've criticised in my time. Voltaire says if God didn't exist, we wouldn't be able to invent him. And I say, witty though that sounds, and reluctant though I am to quarrel with the great encyclopedists of the Enlightenment, in fact, the whole problem to begin with is that God is invented.
Constantly.
In other words, man did not make God. God was made by many. Sorry, God did not make man. Many gods were made by many different men and women. So, in a way, it has it ass backward. Still, I wouldn't want to change Ian McEwan saying that about me.
The book is, as I said,
churlish.
It's intense, it's dense, it covers a lot of life, a lot of personal and political contradictions, paradoxes. And I want to start right up at the end, on almost the last page, talking about another area of conflict. You write, I'd wanted the moral arithmetic to add up. Now, you and I agree on 95% of what goes on in the world, and have for a long time. But the 5% we don't agree on, of course, revolves around the war in Iraq. So let's deal with that before we get on to happier topics. The arithmetic, does it add up for you now?
When I was referring to the moral arithmetic, I was saying that I still wanted things to come out, so to say, to vindicate the left critique, which was the original one of Saddam Hussein, don't forget. I mean, I remember very well in the late 1970s and early 1980s, it was the Iraqi left, some of the Communist Party, the Kurdish opposition, who all of them have a very red past and political formation, so who were saying Baathism is now at a point where it's mutated into fascism. In my old days as an internationalist, what you did as a matter of solidarity was you tried to find out what the movement in the other country wanted and do what was necessary in solidarity with them, and it didn't matter what liberals thought or anyone else thought. That was the great task, and a bit of that is still alive in me. Though, of course, if the majority of the left no longer thinks that's true, as appears to be the case, then all right. To that extent, I have to reconsider. Say, all right, maybe it isn't a left position, but it would still be mine.
I want to simplify it. Let me put it this way: the moral arithmetic in Iraq. I acknowledge the scale of the Baathist horrors. I acknowledge the extent of the mass graves. I acknowledge the gassing of the Kurds and the apocalyptic death toll in the war between Iran and Iraq. But had you known what the invasion would unleash in terms of destruction, death, maiming, not only of the brave US troops, but of course of the Iranian people.
And Australian troops.
Would you have been as enthusiastic?
Well, it's not really a matter of enthusiasm, it's a matter of objectivity. You've decided that it's long overdue to move Iraq into a post-Saddam era, and that in fact the casualties would have been many fewer if that had been done as it, I now think it should have been, at the close of what some people call the first Gulf War, the Kuwait War, which I consider to be the opening phase of a war that didn't end until 2003-04. It's all one war, in other words, with the Saddam regime. And I'll give you an example of what I mean, intervening between those two moments. If Saddam Hussein had been taken out then, huge numbers of the Iraqis, some of the best of them, now dead, would still be alive. And some of the very nastier ones, the leadership of the torturers and administrators of gas to civilian populations, would have been dead or in jail. And that would have been good too. But in the intervening period, I'm sure a lot of your listeners will remember this. Some of them may even have heard themselves saying it. I kept getting petitions saying to me, the sanctions on Iraq are killing, what was it, sometimes 100,000 children a year, sometimes it was more, sometimes it was less.
I remember doing programs.
Civilians, yeah. And I, there was something in me that couldn't quite accept this. I thought the figures could be right. I thought they were sometimes a bit overblown. But when I said to them, fine, if this is true, then we should remove the Saddam Hussein regime, which is the proximate cause of the sanctions. These are United Nations mandated sanctions, after all. Then, by definition, we save a huge number of civilian lives. Immediately, a refusal. No, we don't hate the sanctions and the civilian deaths that much. Not enough to remove the Saddam regime. That's bad faith, pure and simple. They were willing to put up with that level of casualties rather than have regime change. Now, that, excuse me, you're talking to me, Philip. I don't mind, of course, because I'm here to answer questions. But you are talking to me as if it's me who owes the explanation. I don't think this at all. The people who owe the explanation are those who are willing to put up with an enormous number of casualties that they specified were of junior and senior Iraqis mainly, rather than have a removal of what's undoubtedly the root cause, namely the privatization of the Iraqi economy so that it's the wholly owned property of a crime family, and the successive aggression against neighboring states and peoples.
I have no problem with taking him out with a lovely sniper shot. But
well, then let's not say that the collateral figures are the responsibility of those who drew that conclusion.
Collateral. We will never probably know how many died. The figures were obfuscated right throughout the war. But we know that millions were dispossessed. We know that a whole lot of people would probably driven insane if they weren't killed.
Mm-hmm.
At what level does the math...
And probably 750,000 Iranians, don't forget. As
well, that's you accept that
to
thing?
To say nothing of... Well, you accept that thing. I've been to the cemeteries in the greater Tehran area where and elsewhere where Iran commemorates its dead. And, you know, I've done these tours of Anzac memorials and British and French memorials in Northern Europe and in Turkey as well, as many of your listeners will have done, and it's a big part of my historical and cultural interest is this hecatomb athwart the history. I've never seen anything like the cemeteries, war cemeteries in Iran. And I've never met an Iranian in Iran who doesn't have at least one relative unaccounted for or horribly accounted for. I don't think those figures can be very much exaggerated now. We don't know how many Kuwaitis. We have a better figure for the Kurds in Saddam's Anfal campaign, 180,000 at least. That's after the war with Iran is over, by the way. It's when it's in so-called peacetime Iraq. It's when the regime can get busy with trying to destroy a turbulent minority. So I don't feel that it's I who owes an explanation if people want to invoke civilian casualties as their political excuse. No.
Not as a regret.
Well, it would be merely mawkish to say. I mean, one regrets civilian casualties. I mean, why wouldn't it be assumed that I would say that?
It's interesting that far from resiling from the war, you reveal in the book, and I found this quite extraordinary. A group of people, group of friends largely, who sat around thinking about this, talking it up. It wasn't that Christopher Hitchens was appropriated by the Bush administration. You seem to be arguing that, in effect, you characters pushed this war before it was taken up by the neocons.
Well, that's true. I mean, I was a member of a group in Washington that would have attacked Bush if he hadn't taken on Saddam Hussein, and that had attacked Clinton for not doing so, as he and Gore had promised to do. And in the Iraq chapter of my book, I sort of list the members of this open conspiracy, which included, well, Rolf Ekéus, who was the head of the Swedish Socialists, who was the head of the United Nations inspectors, until he was replaced by a more compliant figure by the UN. Peter Galbraith, the son of John Kenneth Galbraith, well-known Scottish-Canadian socialist economist. Peter, the great human rights figure on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Kenan Makia, Iraqi Marxist, who wrote the great anatomy of the Saddam regime, the Republic of Fear. Your humble servant, one or two others. All of us saying that it's well past time that the resolutions of the United Nations respecting Iraq be enforced, and that the resolution passed by both houses of Congress, the Iraq Liberation Act, without, by the way, a single dissenting vote, that it should be the policy of the United States, during the Clinton administration, that it should be the policy of the United States to replace the government of Iraq with a democracy, become operative. Yes. It's the most arduous and sinuous and wrenching political struggle I've ever taken part in, but it's been written up in huge number of outlets since as if it was some kind of conspiracy about the oil fields or shadow thrown by the Israeli lobby, or there's no slander I can think of that wasn't sort of thrown at us. And I thought I'd just take a few pages of my book to try and vindicate the regime change cause.
You also seem to have stumbled across a weapon of mass destruction on your own, virtually.
Well, yes, you could say that. I mean, there are two cases no one ever talks about. One is the book written by Saddam's chief, a bomb maker, Professor Dr. Mahdi Obeidi, who was in charge of the program for a long time, who kept the evidence buried in his own garden in Baghdad, a centrifuge or two. Those, as you know, the crown jewels of the process. And a couple of shelves of paper about how to make it all work. And he was ordered, directed to bury and conceal this by none other than Qusay Hussein, one of the two adorable Hussein children who were waiting to take over when their father went mad. Glad we didn't have to wait for that. And then, yes, I was shown evidence that there was the ingredients of the elements of a chemical weapon being hidden underneath a mosque in central Baghdad, a Sunni mosque, by someone in the Defense Department, but actually told not to make any use of it. I was supposed to be shown it, but not to publicize it. I wasn't being sold a bill of goods. And there's evidence after the fall of Baghdad that there it was, just where they said it was going to be. My naive belief was, if you could show that weapons were being hidden in a mosque, it would upset and outrage many people in the Muslim world. Of course, there I really was naive. Suicide bombing belts are concealed in Iraqi infant schools, and no one thinks that that's horrible. And by the way, if you ever wonder where the civilian casualties are coming from, you might look at the efforts made by the Baathists and their allies in Al-Qaeda to destroy and maim Iraqi society.
Of course, one then freely acknowledges,
yes, well,
that.
I think you do.
We talk about
you do,
what's
but very
unleashed.
Often people say, as a consequence of the invasion. Well, it's not really true, or it's a shady way of putting it, when it's self-evident that even today, now the Iraqis have their own government, where you can read in the paper, today the Iraqi Supreme Court argued about a recount while the parliamentary numbers were put on hold and different parties worked out how to form a coalition. Has anyone any idea how amazing it is to be reading this kind of thing about Iraq? When 5 years ago, people were being prodded at bayonet point to vote 100% in a mad referendum on a dictator. This is extraordinary, and where the bombs continue to go off completely pitilessly, outside polling places, schools, hospitals, clinics, all the time. And no one's blaming this on the coalition, are they?
The book is a study of quite a few friendships.
Yes.
It's also a revelation about the magnitude of friendships lost. Some of your oldest, dearest allies over the decades gone. You seem to say, well, stuff them. I find that hard to believe, that you don't find it deeply wounding.
I don't do it myself. So I mean, unless with one case I'll come to in a second, I don't break off relations with people because of political disagreements. Someone would have to go very, very far, become a racist, say, or something of this kind, before I'd say, well, we can't be friends on this basis. So if people want to drop me because of a political disagreement, I regard it as regrettable, but as meaning that the friendship can't have been that well-founded in the first place, if you follow me. So I don't go around picking fights with friends. I mean, I've had a lot of friendships that have survived a lot of political disagreement. I'll give you another example. I write quite a lot about my friend Martin Amis in a longish chapter, which is designed to ask the question, can you have a heterosexual relationship with a chap? My answer being, yeah, I think you probably can.
I'm glad.
At least qualify. At least if it's possible to have a heterosexual relationship with a chap, this is the best try I've been able to make at it. Now, Martin wrote a book about the history of Stalinism called Cope with the Dread, which I don't think is by any means his best book, in which he made some quite disobliging remarks about me, and I could have actually fantastically hurt, but I just wrote a review putting him right on it. Whereas when Edward Said, about whom I do write a longer, almost as long a chapter, wrote an attack on a certain position he said some people took on Iraq, and without naming me, quoting me, and again without naming me, saying he considered this position to be racist, I thought, well, I'm not dropping him because he said this, because he didn't say it about me, but I'm presuming he's dropped me, because I think I have to take him seriously on this. That must mean goodbye if he says this, whether he said it directly to me or not. I wouldn't have a friend I thought was a racist.
Did you drop Vidal, or did Vidal drop you?
Gore dropped me, as is his perfect right, but he once wrote a nice note to me, it was about 12 years ago now, saying he decided, unsolicited, I might add, I mean, just a nice note saying, do you know what the word Delfino means? And I said, no, I don't. It sounds like Dauphin. He said, well, it does mean Dauphin, I tell him. And I've decided to appoint you my Delfino, my heir in waiting. And I said, well, that's fantastically nice of you. I mean, he and I have had our disagreements, but I was and I am a huge admirer of his historical novels and many of his essays. I took it kindly, and a few years later I said, would he mind if I put it in as a blurb on the back of one of my books? He said that's one of the reasons he offered it to me. And more recently, since 9/11, where he took the position effectively that the Bush administration had colluded in bringing about the attacks, a mad view that I know is held by a few people but shouldn't be indulged by people of his stature, we had a big falling out. I stopped using the quotation. And then more recently, he started saying that I'd gone around claiming to be his heir, which was, I don't particularly mind him rewriting our history. That's what he was doing now. I mind more he's rewriting the history of the combat with Al-Qaeda. So on the back of this book, I have his endorsement crossed out with a red line through it by me saying, no, not anymore.
I
think he'll get that message and he'll appreciate its feline quality if he's got any of that left.
I wonder what he would make of the very, very moving chapter on you and Martin Amis.
Well, I don't think it's Gore's ambition to have heterosexual relationships with men. But I think, yes, he might see the point of it also.
Yeah.
And whenever I quote him in the book, I happen to notice that, almost without exception, I'm quoting him admiringly, but from the old days, the certain things he said that are and will always remain very funny and very pointful.
I'm under an ongoing death threat from a guy in Melbourne who has decided I have to go because I share your view on the insanity of suggesting a regime as incompetent as the Bush regime could bring off the destruction of the Twin Towers and others. It is one of the strangest conspiracy theories around, isn't it?
Well, yes, I mean, but remember, when you read as we've all had to, FBI field agents forwarding news about people in the flight schools in the Midwest to HQ and being told, shut up, stop bothering us with this kind of thing. When you read that...
But that's incompetence, not conspiracy.
Well, that's quite a high level of the people who... field agents in watching the flight schools telling HQ, we don't like the look of these guys planning to train on a flight simulator, but they're not interested in knowing how to land the plane, only how to take it off and fly it. Come on, this is amazing. When the first words cited by George Tenet, head of the CIA, when he's seen the plane sitting in the towers, first words are, gee, I hope it's not any of those boys from the flight schools in the Midwest. That's the head of the CIA. When John Walker Lind, a nutcase from California, is the only American who succeeded in infiltrating the Taliban because he wants to join it, really does want to join it, and the CIA couldn't get anyone to infiltrate with millions and millions of dollars spent on human and other forms of intelligence, you do have a difficulty persuading people that this is just cock-up rather than conspiracy.
It was quite
a long way beyond the level of... I mean, I know what the explanations are, and I've painstakingly been through them, but I understand why people thought
I understand the suspicions. One shares suspicions on a multitude of issues. I, in fact, am in possession of emails which show that there were no planes. The ones that we saw, they were holograms.
Oh yes, I've had all that too.
Yeah.
No, this thing has a long tradition, and it goes back actually to something Gore Vidal has also long believed, and I've always known he long believed, which is Pearl Harbor was a setup as well.
But that's another link. I'm astonished we're talking about this as much as we are. But who was it? It was one of the hierarchy.
Talking about me, moi.
One of the hierarchy in the Bush administration, looking at the polls prior to 9/11, said we do rather need a Pearl Harbor.
It was often said that nothing but a Pearl Harbor would awaken people to the danger of Middle Eastern terrorism. Yeah, that there would need to be some shocking event before people would stop being complacent about it. They thought the United States was invulnerable, protected by the Atlantic and the Pacific and by Canada and Mexico, and that's the way most people did feel. As a matter of fact, they still do.
We interrupt this program.
In spite of a Pearl.
There's a newsflash just come in, Christopher. Forgive me.
Please.
The Pope has been arrested at Heathrow Airport. Now, that will make you very happy.
Yes. It's a bit premature, this announcement, but he's going to try and land there in September, I think it is.
Now, he tried to sneak in early.
Ah, well, perhaps to help exhume Cardinal Newman, who he's intending to come and canonise, who, as you know, was buried... This seems to be a recurrent trope in our conversation, was buried in the same grave as another chap, his best friend for many years. Recently exhumed in the hope of separating his remains from the other chap, but the remains are unfortunately inseparable and indistinguishable. Anyway, that's the proximate cause of his visit, but the Catholic Church has made a huge mistake. I think it's only just begun to realise it. In proclaiming as the Vicar of Christ on earth and its head and father, a man who was for a long time personally responsible for, not just institutionally as head of the Sacred Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, but personally in several cases, what we've come to recognise as a very sordid, deep-going cover-up of... let's not even say cover-up, because I think part of the problem with all this is euphemism. Obstruction of justice in the case of a very major crime, which we wrongly call abuse, and which is the rape and torture and molestation of children. A very grave sin, no doubt, but certainly a very grave crime.
You've been called...
And so now they've made themselves answerable, and answerability is coming.
Do you think?
Yes.
How will it manifest?
The Pope's already been named personally in several important lawsuits in the United States. He's about to be named in an opinion that is going to be filed in Great Britain by my candidate for Greatest Living Australian, Jeff Robertson, great learned barrister and human rights counsel in London, on all these points, including the defence that the Vatican, which knows it's vulnerable, has already announced it will make. Remember, they're not so stupid as not to know that they have made themselves vulnerable by having as their head this man, Joseph Ratzinger. They've said they'll claim sovereign immunity, because he's not just head of the Church, he's head of the Vatican, head of a state. Well, if they choose to remind people that Vatican City was created by Mussolini, that it's a rump state with no real existence, that it's the last surviving bit of the architecture of European fascism in the politics of Europe, let them do so. But then they open themselves to further charges. For example, the State Department doesn't make a human rights report on the Vatican, as it does on every other state the United States recognizes, on the grounds that it isn't really a state. It isn't. It's only got observer status at the United Nations. if they claim that they are a state, then they'll have to have a human rights report done every year by the State Department. And I know what, I can tell you now what that'll be about. So there's nowhere they can run or hide for what they've done. It's gone on too long. It was covered up too horribly. And it's ridiculous and I think disgraceful that it should be left to private individuals like myself, Jeff Robertson, QC, Richard Dawkins and others to do this. Where is the Department of Public Prosecutions? Where is the Attorney General? You've read the Christian report on the Christian Brothers' treatment of the British orphans in Australia, for example. What is the law doing about it? It's not enough to apologise.
Sorry, Dave, won't do it. Really.
Well, I'm not so sure. Well, at least the question should be asked. Why is it being left to private individuals, including many victims, to pursue this matter?
One of my favourite American writers for decades has been Gary Wills. Mm. Ever since I read Nixon Agonostes, God help us, 30 years ago.
Yes, great man. Augustinian Catholic.
And he writes superbly on this great dilemma of the church, where sexuality is so mutated, so denied, that it leads to an infantile response to a prolonged puberty, which manifests itself in these phenomena. What, if you were Pope, and I don't think that's likely, how could you begin to reconstruct a Catholic Church to get rid of this, what has now become for Catholicism, its own original sin?
Well, I don't think it can be done because it's not just an all-male and celibate environment that's the problem. I mean, celibacy is not what makes people rape children. If you allow priests to get married, that doesn't mean that those of them for whom only children will do would stop doing it. There are people for whom only children will do. We have a special name for it. Incidentally, that name should not be paedophilia, which means the love of children. It should be pederasty, which is a much more accurate description of it. The whole thing is rotten with euphemism all the time. Always look to the language. If my book says any one thing, it's always to take care of what words are being used. They're always very revealing. The whole teaching about original sin, the Ratzinger idea that children should be brought into the confessional as soon as they've been confirmed, and the confessional is where a lot of the recruitment and molestation actually went on. The idea that children are in effect imps of Satan, that they can be taught horrible things like your Protestant friends will go to hell. All that's in living memory. There will be many of your listeners who will remember being told things like that by men in holy orders. This is what's rotten with it.
Christopher, you were right to point out that we're meant to be talking about you, so let's now start doing that. Since we last met...
The memoirs, as Gore used to...
Since we last met...
Used to say.
Both of us have discovered that we're Jewish. Both of us have discovered that this was hushed up in the family. Tell us about your extraordinary mother.
Well, my mother came from a family of German-Polish stock who'd left Eastern Central Europe long before the catastrophe. But when in the mid-late 9th century it was becoming obvious to some Jews that trouble was coming, they left and moved to Liverpool, in fact, in England, and had more or less assimilated by the time I was born, or rather by the time my mother met my father, which she did because they both joined the Navy in the Second World War. And it was her decision, and I can probably guess, I think, what motivated it, that she didn't want to be Jewish anymore. She wanted to be English, she wanted to pass, and she wanted her children not to be identified as Jewish. She wanted certainly her firstborn son, that's me, to be an English gentleman, so you be the judge of how well that plan worked out. But that meant, though, that there was a certain element of what people now call denial in our family. I knew there was something I didn't know, and it had to do with my mother's mother, my old granny. But I might never have found out if my mother hadn't died tragically and young, and if my grandmother hadn't survived her and my father and broken it to my brother and to myself.
Star-crossed lovers. Your father was so different in every way, wasn't he?
Well, my father really was a sort of stolid Anglo-Saxon, unemotional type who spent most of his life in uniform and who told me once that the only time he'd ever felt he knew what he was doing was as an active service naval officer in the Second World War, where he had a very hard time. And had been disappointed by everything since, including by life in civilian work after the Navy let him go at the end of the war, which he never quite forgave them for. So he was in a very marked, this was stoic type, very marked contrast to my rather more emotional and liberal and literary type.
But he practiced another form of denial, didn't he? Emotional denial.
Well, he was a very tightly wrapped guy. I don't remember very many conversations with him. He was pessimistic, painfully honest, except in one respect he lied about his age. I found that out rather late. By only a couple of years, too. It didn't seem to matter, but he must have been sensitive because he was quite a lot older than my mama.
It's interesting that the book, the last sentence in the book is about your father.
Yes.
I find that for the remainder of my days, I shall be happy enough to see if I can emulate the understatement of Commander Hitchens and to say that at least I know what I'm supposed to be doing.
Yes, well, that's the harvest or fruit of having had in my life a number of commitments, a lot of which I've hashed out on the air with you, Philip, none of which I'm ashamed of, but a lot of which suffered from diminishing returns to me, to the extent that they involved a certainty or a sort of an allegiance that couldn't be altered. And now I find myself mainly aligned with a group of people whose essential ideology is scepticism. I mean, we, those of us in the atheist and rationalist community, really are quite convinced that, given that we now know so much less all the time about more and more that we're finding out about, that the one position that's completely useless is anything that's faith-based. So that I can finally commit myself to a group of people whose whole outlook is that of doubt. But that this doesn't mean...
Which, of course, renders us politically impotent in a sense. We're never going to form a great organisation or have an atheist pope. We won't have battalions.
No, indeed, but then probably the belief that one was going to do that any other way turned out to be delusory.
And dangerous.
And possibly dangerous, too. So, and not all that I learned in the battle against other forms of totalitarianism was wasted on me. And I always thought anyway that theocracy was the original form that totalitarianism takes. This is, you know, there was an absolute authority, completely unquestioned, not derived by human beings, but human beings made by it. The worst kind of dictatorship you can imagine, one that can't be altered. All of that, of course, is complete nonsense, but it doesn't mean that. I mean, for example, Richard Dawkins and I and others, after the Haitian earthquake, issued an appeal for people, a way of people to raise money and give it, so that they knew it wasn't being used for religious proselytization by some sectarian charity, raised a lot of money, did a fair amount of good for the people of Haiti. It doesn't mean one does nothing or is neutral by any means or anodyne, but it does mean that we don't have any ideological, well, I'll say it again, certainty or absolutism.
That's another thing that, right through the book, isn't
that, it? That makes me feel that that and the amount of inquiry that's necessary, the amount of hard work to try and be less ignorant about the increasing number of things that are wonderful that we've only just found out about. We've only just found out this month that we have the same genes as the Neanderthals. We weren't sure about this till recently, but this late species was our cousin 50,000 years ago. An incredible thought, along with several other humanish species that, if they had a god and they certainly had a religion, abandoned them. Huge amount of work to be done on this. I'm not going to be told in the meantime that we already know all we need to know because we have a few holy books.
Christopher, has it changed you in any way to discover that you are, through the line of mothers, technically Jewish?
Not as much as I once thought it might, in that my attitude to anti-Semitism was already a very decided one, but... like all prejudices, but I think worse than some, because it's so full of conspiracy and pseudo-intellectual paranoia, and because it has this thirst for murder in it, anti-Semitism in an individual is always a very, very bad sign. And as it is in a society, all societies that have suffered from it have undergone terrible trauma and decline. I couldn't really have added anything to my view
about that
which I'd studied as a subject. And my view that Zionism is probably a false messiah, that the problems facing the Jewish people will probably not be solved by moving to a statelet in the middle of the Muslim world and dispossessing another people. That position hasn't altered either. What has altered in the recent past, but this is nothing to do with my own genes, I try not to think with my epidermis or my blood. These are not thinking organs. I've changed a bit my attitude to anti-Zionism. In the last few years, there's arisen a movement, Islamic Jihad, some call it Hamas, others call it the Iranian Islamic Republic, who quite clearly are Judeo-cidal in their politics and in their ambitions, in the way that the nationalists of Palestine were and are not, or most of them were and are not. So I've been forced to confront the fact that my criticism of Zionism may be much what it was, but my attitude towards some of its other critics has to be much more critical.
I've got to identify you and the program. You are Christopher Hitchens. The program is Late Night Live on ABC Radio National, etc. You remember a line of Lyndon Johnson, which was famously bowdlerised into, he can't walk and chew gum at the same time. The original was, he can't walk and fart at the same time. Your book is about thinking contrapuntally at the same time. Again and again, you make the point it is possible, in fact even desirable, to have a paradoxical struggle going on in your own consciousness.
Well, or you might as well say inevitable, actually, on reflection. Scott Fitzgerald says somewhere that the only real test of anybody's usefulness is their ability to hold two contradictory thoughts in the head at the same time, while admitting that that's what they're doing. I mean, everyone does it. Some people say that they are consistent when they're not. The critical thing is to realize that, you know, the dialectic does operate, and it operates inside you too. I thought of calling the book at one point Both Sides Now. And it was certainly written, a lot of it was written with that as the working title, so as to show that wherever I was, whatever I was doing, I was always fatally aware that there was another side of the argument. And sometimes I found it, in a guilty way, even attractive to consider what the other side was thinking. Now I consider it more in the nature of a responsibility to do that.
Do you find that possible when you contemplate the people in the world who you most profoundly loathe, the Islamist fascists? Can you begin to see how they see the world?
Yes.
And have some sympathy for it?
Well, the sympathy isn't necessary as long as one can do the job of trying to state their case as well as they could. I mean, the question is not sympathy so much, though everyone's human, but objectivity, being able to put their case. Yeah, I can. I could do it. I know that they feel terrible at the loss of what was once, to them, a very comforting empire, the caliphate. Mm. That they feel that its replacement was profane and chaotic, that humanity can't be happy until it's restored and indeed extended. I know how that feels, partly because I was brought up in a family and a society who was suffering terrible post-imperial pangs. In other words, Britain in the 1950s and early 60s, which is my upbringing. I can see that. I can see that they feel the intrusion of Zionism into the state, Zionism into the region, as something very disruptive and as representing a permanent injustice to the Arab people, or the non-Jewish people, not just the Arab people, of the Druze, the Armenians, all non-Jews. I can see that. I obviously have difficulty imagining what it would be like to believe that the Quran was a holy book. I can't imagine what it would be like to feel that, no, any more than I can imagine the idea that Jesus died for my sins as a real idea. I can't, sorry. But I know what I have an instinct about profanity and the feeling that their altars have been profaned. I mean, that sense, yes. What I can't allow it to do, any imaginative sympathy of this kind, is to say, oh, well, that means I'm entitled to go and kill anyone I want because I hear voices in my head that are from God. In fact, the better you understand what the supposed grievances are, the less obvious it seems that there could be any recourse to this kind of cruelty and madness and fanaticism.
One wonders what voices in the head an atheist is going to have, or to whom he might attribute them.
Well, people sometimes say to me, well, what if you were to have a religious experience? And I say, well, what would it be? I don't know. The most common ones are, you know, the Virgin Mary appears to me. She never seems to appear to non-Catholics.
No.
So I've no idea. But if she did, I would first, I think, want to check that I wasn't having a hallucination. I wouldn't immediately think, well, I've been chosen by a nodding or weeping statue.
No. Or you'd had one too many bottles of Johnny Walker.
For example, there are all kinds of... and there's work to be that has been done on prophets and visionaries of the past and their relationship to what we now know about epilepsy and schizophrenia. So I think it's quite possible to think of it as partly clinical, but I don't want to be condescending to people who really do have these experiences.
One of the great things about the book is...
Or rather, I would say with Henry James, in the varieties of religious experience, people who have these experiences, I think, are entitled to be treated as if they're subjectively true for them, they're real for them, as long as they don't try and make it real for me.
But you did have a religious experience, and I'm about to reveal it.
Ah.
The book has got lots of jokes in it. It's often very funny. And there's one story that I
hadn't... Would you mind just saying that bit again?
It's got lots of jokes in it.
Many
it's
jokes.
Very funny. And to me, the funniest, apart from your revelation that you had a couple of affairs with blokes who finished up being in the Thatcher cabinet, involves the great dominatrix herself.
Yes.
And it has you, at her request, bending over publicly. Witnesses.
Yes.
Sticking out your pert buttocks.
Indeed.
And allowing her to smack them.
Yes. And being sad when it was over. Yes, if anyone hasn't guessed, this is my first meeting with the then Mrs. Margaret Thatcher, or actually she was then Mrs. Janice Thatcher, that's how she was referred to in the Times, just elected editor of the Conservative opposition, and not fancied very much as likely to win the next election. And I went to a reception in the House of Lords where I met her, and we had I picked a fight with her, actually, about what was then Rhodesia, is now Zimbabwe. And though she was in the wrong, she maintained her position so well that I thought, OK, I'll give it up. I mean, this is just too small a disagreement. We should move on. And I bowed, as if to acknowledge this. She said, no, bow lower. I'm thinking, what? I found I had no control. I just did bow lower. I said, no, much lower. Till I was practically bent double, and she thwacked me on the ass with a rolled-up parliamentary order paper. And I regained the vertical with some difficulty to meet her sort of very flirtatious gaze. And I thought, as I left, I walked home, I thought, this woman has real power over guys, and she knows how to use it. And it never surprised me later that one by one she absolutely massacred all the old male Tories who'd got in her way and established herself as unchallenged.
What makes the story all the funnier is that you like smacking their bottoms, the bottoms of the mighty. And I couldn't help but chortle at the demolition jobs you did on various presidents. You just obliterate them in a sentence. The only one you have left out is the incumbent. Is he about to be obliterated by you, as I remember you doing so powerfully with Clinton?
Actually, looking back when I read my book, which was very hard to do when you finished, I noticed the one I was rudest about was Reagan. I could still remember, even though he looks better in retrospect than we thought at the time. I'm very, very rude about what a terrible liar and phony he was for so much of the time, and the appalling things he said about fascism and the utter ignorance that he displayed on so many questions. But not to duck your question, I voted for then-Senator Obama positively as well as negatively. I obviously couldn't vote for the McCain-Palin team. That was made very clear to me. And quite a lot of quite conservative people I know refused to do it as well. It seemed morally impossible to vote Republican that year. But it wasn't just that. It was a positive vote. And actually, it was because I admired Obama as a writer. Maybe this is a sort of too much a party pre thing to say, but since writing in language is all that I really care about or know anything about, it was very amazing to have a candidate
who wrote his own books and wrote them beautifully.
Yes, yes. Certainly, at least the first one, very, very beautifully. And not even David Remnick, whose book shows that some of Obama's stories are somewhat improved, I mean, as one might expect. could quite shake me on that. It wasn't that they were well written, they were the revelation of a self-critical and humorous and reflective character. And so I thought, well, this is a chance we shouldn't miss. And incidentally, while we are at it, I've believed for many, many years, and I'm sure I'm right, the United States was perfectly ready to vote for a non-Anglo-Saxon president. Absolutely. Even one from Africa. I knew that was...
I'm sorry, when did you know that? It wasn't apparent
when Jesse Jackson, when Jesse Jackson fouled up the possibilities, he wasn't the right guy. So I thought, well, while we're at it, let's get this out of the way too. But that wouldn't have been my reason for doing it. But I think it's positive, and it is actually rather amazing. My children go to the same school as his daughters. My daughter goes to the same school as his daughters. The person in politics who, or at least in presidential politics last time, who had the most model family life and spoke by far the best English was the one who had African genes. Well, of course, we all have African genes, but you know what I mean. I think that is partly what maddens the Tea Party right wing. They can't stand the fact that he speaks English better than them. And that he's...
But if you look at the Tea Party side of politics, here, with one nation, there, whatever, is always... The spokespeople are always entirely inarticulate, whether it's Joe Bjelke-Petersen here, Sarah Palin there. They don't trust or... They don't like language, and they don't trust people who use it well.
No. And Obama, since you wanted me to be not totally uncritical, and I'm not totally uncritical, has the tendency, and he had it in the campaign towards the end, and has it now, of being so well-spoken that he'll drone on for far too long. He doesn't quite know how to wind up a point, and he's too keen on listening to himself. And he also, I think, has a fatal weakness, which is that he thinks that a lot of international disagreements, such as the one we have with Iran, say, are largely the result of misunderstandings and miscommunications, that a better communication and better articulation would solve them. And
this is the Cairo speech, isn't it?
I'm just too old and disillusioned and embittered and hard-bitten to think that. I mean, I think there are such things as real conflicts of interest between nations and classes, and that they don't get solved by ameliorative talk.
So where are we at with him at the moment, in your view? You're still rooting for him?
Oh, yeah. And he has some sinew to him, as he showed in winning the healthcare debate, when many people had written him off, especially after the result in Massachusetts. Came back very effectively. I think that was designed for foreign consumption as well. Don't take me for a wimp. I think the way that he dealt with the Somali piracy episode a little while ago, taking out the pirates with the Navy SEALs, and then not making a speech boasting about it, that's what impressed me. He did something that was quite risky. It worked very well. It sent the signal to those who needed to hear it, and it's been largely forgotten because, unlike Reagan, he didn't make a huge USA, USA, we're number one, you can run, you can't hide, no braggartry. I like that bit, even though it cost him, because he isn't famous for it.
But none of them.
Carter, yeah, but that's too easy. I say in my book, I forget why I say it now, that it's an example I'm using. It's about relativism. The Teamsters Union leader who was asked, well, wouldn't you say, this is at the hearings, wouldn't you say, Mr. Schiaparelli, that your union's really powerful in the American trucking industry? And he looks around himself, was sitting there as if he hasn't taken the coat hanger out of his suit yet, and the lawyer says, no, you have to answer that. And he says, well, Senator, being powerful, a bit like being ladylike, if you have to say you are, you probably ain't. That's the affect that I like.
Swinging back in the last seconds we have, or the last minutes, is atheism another intellectual fad? In other words, will it pass through the public consciousness like a pig through a boa constrictor, or are we making substantial gains?
Oh, no, I think the position of religious certainty is increasingly ridiculous to people intellectually, and that's for excellent reason, because of the extraordinary level of discovery that we now have that appears to contradict any idea of creation or revelation, let alone redemption. That's the first thing. And the second is the ugly form it takes in reaction to its defeat intellectually in theocratic terms. In other words, directly threatening to democratic discourse and the open society. Jihadism, crazed Israeli settlers trying to bring on the stealing other people's property. Iranian mullahs moving nearer to a nuke. A thing that isn't mentioned enough, the terrible role of the Russian Orthodox Church in keeping the Putin regime going as a nationalist, chauvinist, expansionist regime in Russia. That's something we're going to have to be watching out for. Idiots trying to teach nonsense to American school children with public money. There's a big desire to push back to all that. What I wish is that we could call it something else than an unbelief. I mean, all that I say by atheism is what I don't believe. Mm. It's rather, that's the least of it. What I'm trying to talk about is a positive humanism. We don't have a word for it yet. Atheism is inescapable. I'll affirm it while that's the case. But I don't have a word for why I don't believe in the tooth fairy.
But you're also suspicious of terms that end in ism, aren't you? I mean, I've been involved with humanists all my life, but there's something, it can take on a quasi-religiosity.
Well, unfortunately, we are pattern-seeking mammals. We can't avoid the fact that it is in our nature. All we can do is know that it's true of us, as with the contradictions. We're not going to be able to live without contradiction. We're not going to be able to overcome it either. The critical thing is to know that one suffers from it and to be aware of it and to be on guard against it. And that means that faith is the most overrated of the virtues, if it's a virtue at all. More about the jokes.
Yeah, no, it's a very funny book, full of jokes. When I was involved with the Festivals of Ideas in Brisbane and Adelaide, we tried to get you out again and again and again, always hit the wall. Why did you decide?
Last time I was here, I sang at the Sydney Opera House and you didn't come.
No, I know, but what possessed you to come to the Sydney Writers' Festival? You get a million invitations. Why did you choose?
Well, I love Sydney, and I was here recently, but it was the last, didn't coincide with you being here, when I was able to sing the whole of the Monty Python Philosopher's Song at the Sydney Opera House and didn't realise till it was over that this meant I had sung where Dame Nellie Melba had once sung. It isn't over till the chubby boy sings. So I couldn't wait to come back. And my Australian publishers are very nice, and they produced a lovely edition of my book. And in fact, it's being launched down under. This is the first place it's on sale.
So, you're kidding?
No, so I wanted to...
Who's launching it?
Do you want to read it all out?
Yeah.
Available at fine bookstores everywhere. Allen and Unwin Publishers.
Fine publishers.
Fine publishers everywhere. Fine bookstores everywhere. Try and go to an indie one if you can. It's called Hitch 22. A memoir.
Well, Christopher, it's lovely to see you.
That would bear repetition. Yeah.
We'll put it on our website as well.
Would you
look? I actually read it in galley form, which gave it a sort of extra drama.
Got to get
one
with the pictures. The pictures make it.
I didn't have any pictures. It's got pictures.
They're terrific pictures.
Bloody hell! Look at all those beaut pictures. You with some very, very strange people, Christopher Hitchens,
and in strange positions.
Shut up while I say goodbye to you, for heaven's sake. Christopher Hitchens, if he didn't exist, we wouldn't be able to invent him from one of the sort of heterosexual phalanx that surrounds you. The book, as
despite
he says,
myself,
is Hitch 22, a memoir. But it's not a bloody memoir. It's a great thumping autobiography. That's a wrap for another week of LNL. Thanks to the team, Paul Goff, Lila Schooner, Alex Barry. Alex is new to us, but he's doing a great job. Catherine Merchant, Umrutha Slee, and EP Kate McDonald. Don't forget the classic tomorrow night. Have a lovely weekend. See you next week.
If you go down to the Tasmanian woods today, you could be in for a big surprise. Archenemies talking together about the future of the forests. After decades of acrimony and argument, timber interests and environmentalists are seeking common ground in response to a massive downturn in the wood products industry. In the National Interest with me, Peter Mayers. Download or stream this program from the Radio National website.